What are the most important principles for living you've learned? Some years ago, I asked myself this question. Since then, time and experience have provided answers and insights leading to the laws of spirit. These laws belong to each of us. They are found within our hearts and lie at the heart of every religion, culture, and moral system. One method I use to access these universal laws is to ask, if I met my higher self in the mountains, in the form of a wise being, what would that being teach me? This question taps the wellspring of wisdom within us all. All journeys are true, but not all are factual. In the Laws of Spirit, I present spiritual laws for life through a series of conversations and experiences with a fictional sage, a woman of extraordinary grace and understanding who teaches through vivid imagery from the natural world. Unlike my previous full-length adventures, this book more closely resembles a parable than a novel. The archetypal figure of the mountain sage gives these simple yet powerful truths their own visceral and emotional reality. As the sage guides me along the mountain paths, I invite my readers to travel with me and explore the most illuminating laws we are destined to master on the winding paths of life. These laws have expanded my perspectives and provided leverage to change the course of my life. I hope and trust they will do the same for you. Over the years, for health and enjoyment, I've often hiked into the wilderness near my home, up the narrow deer trails and down forested hillsides covered with oak, pine, and manzanita, wandering as impulse has taken me along the mountains leading to the coast. On one such occasion, some years ago, when my wife and daughters were away for a long weekend, I rose before dawn and set out without a plan except to climb at leisure and explore a new country. The mountains, no more than a few thousand feet high, still had enough rises and dips to lose sight of civilization, evoking a sense of mystery and wonder as I imagined myself 100 miles from anywhere. The rolling hills reflected the peaks and valleys of my own inner life. At the moment, I felt lost in a valley filled with shadows of doubt. My life had fallen into an orderly routine. So on this particular morning, I took with me into the hills an unspoken desire for excitement, for insight, for change. I was soon to discover the truth of that saying, "Be careful what you ask for, you might get it." On this morning, low clouds had drifted in from the coast to settle over the wilderness, and after I had hiked up some distance, I found myself in a fold between the hills, enveloped in a thick fog, so I could see no more than a few feet ahead. The air became cold and still, and I soon lost any sense of direction. Hearing a stream somewhere below, I kept it behind me, thinking I might climb up and out of this shrouded valley. I soon came to a plateau nestled beneath some ancient oaks, just above a steep drop-off. I had, quite by accident, approached the plateau from the only possible angle, a narrow path between a wall of boulders. As I climbed around one of the massive stones, the fog disappeared to reveal a tiny hut standing before me. I approached and tapped lightly on the door. To my surprise, a resonant voice rang out with unexpected warmth, as if I were a long-awaited guest. "Do come in, traveler. Come in." And so, wandering off the beaten path of my life, I opened the door and found the sage sitting quietly, smiling up at me. For no reason I could discern, goosebumps appeared on my arms. She sat there with a feline grace, erect yet relaxed, balanced upon a cushion of leaves on the earthen floor. She was dressed in a green tunic. "Maybe she thinks she's in Sherwood Forest," I thought. Her eyes held my attention, almond eyes, hazel-colored, illumined by rays of sunlight shining through a crack in the wall. Eyes set like jewels in a face of smooth olive skin, crowned by short brown hair that gave no clear sign of her age, race, or culture. She seemed to be surrounded by a bright field of energy, which I assumed was a trick of the light. I began to feel oddly disoriented. I lost my bearings in time as well as space. Was this a primeval rainforest, a hillside in Shakespeare's England, the Scottish Highlands, or a mountain abode of the Chinese immortals? "A long time since I've had a visitor," she said. "I'm glad you have come, for I have much to share, and I need your assistance in a mission of great importance." Was she lost? Did she need a guide? Puzzled but intrigued, I only said, That sounds interesting. I believe you'll find it so, she replied. But first, you'll need some training to prepare you. Prepare me? If this is going to take more than a couple of hours, I'm not sure I have the time. You have both less and more time than you imagine, she said. A strange response. Judging her odd but harmless, I decided to play along and see where this led. She gestured for me to sit down. Make yourself comfortable, traveler. I know why you have come and that you have journeyed far. I was about to tell her that we were only an hour's hike from my home. Then I sensed she was referring not to my morning's walk, but to the long and winding path of my life. Abruptly, my mind was flooded with countless images, impressions of many different times and cultures. I had a strange sense that they were somehow connected with her. Then doubt entered my mind. Surely, I thought, she's just a reclusive woman, and I'm weaving an adventure where there is none. Who are you? I asked. A reflection in a quiet pond, she said. A ray of moonlight on a dark night. As young as the morning dew and as old as the earth. All things are in me, and I am in all things. Beyond that, traveler, I cannot say, for my life is as mysterious as yours. The only difference between us is that I live in the embrace of a spirit to which you are just awakening. Speechless at first, I finally asked, what should I call you? Do you have a name? A name? She looked genuinely surprised. I've had so many names, I hardly remember. Well, what do you call yourself? I hardly ever call myself, she replied with a smile, and that was that. Well, where do you come from? I venture forth from the past and the future. I live in the eternal present. We've lost and found one another time and time again. I've worked with you in an old gas station and walked with you through the Hawaiian rainforest. I've lived in great cities. I've sat in high courts under arched domes lined with silver and gold. I've known the comforts of hearth and home and the solitude of the mountain monastery. I've labored in dusty fields, known the risk and riches of high enterprise, and felt the cold lash of poverty. I've walked beneath jeweled canopies of stars through shadows cast by moonlight. I've traveled the seas, won and lost fortunes, known health and illness, pleasure and pain. And I have found treasures that would dazzle your eyes, luminescent silks, opals as large as fists, and sparkling gems of every color. But I would share with you the greatest treasure of all, a gift that grows in the giving and never loses its luster. As she continued, her voice was the voice of all people, shifting like the wind, blowing through dusty hallways of history and places of radiant light. Magic is alive in the world, traveler. I intend to share with you the secrets of alchemy. You mean like turning lead into gold, I asked? She smiled. Playing with minerals is a mere chemist's trick. The alchemy of which I speak can transmute the baser elements of your life, the fears, confusion, concerns, and difficulties you encounter, into the gold of freedom and clarity, serenity and joy. The laws of spirit are the secrets I would share. You refer to spirit. Do you believe in God? Do you have a religion? I asked. She smiled again. You don't have to believe in the sun to delight in the warmth of the morning light. It is simply obvious. That is how I know God. And as to my religion, she continued, gazing into the distance as if remembering times past, I've sat in the shining temples of the Israelites and under the glorious spires of the mosques of Islam. I've knelt in the great cathedrals and bathed in the light of Christendom. I've sat in the sweat lodges and passed the pipe. Lived as a shaman on the African plains, meditated in Buddhist temples, and inhaled the sweet aroma of incense on the banks of the Ganges. And everywhere I found the same spirit in all religions, a divine will that transcends time, belief, and culture, revealing the universal laws that are the treasure of God. Can you say more about these laws? I asked. I intend to, she answered. For within the mystery of life, the universe operates according to laws as real as the law of gravity. Woven into the fabric of existence, reflecting the primal intelligence of the universe, These laws of spirit direct the mechanics of the universe, the movements of flowers reaching toward the sun and waves thundering to the shore. They govern the movement of the earth, the cycle of the seasons, and the forces of nature. To their songs, even the galaxies dance. Suddenly, with a puff of smoke and a strange whooshing sound, a small pile of branches and twigs in a circle of stones between us ignited, as if the flames had lit themselves. "Merlin taught me that," she said, her eyes twinkling. Even in my present state of awe, a skeptical part of me thought, well, maybe it's Merlin, and maybe it's lighter fluid. Then, as we watched a thin plume of smoke drift up through the hut's thatched roof, she resumed speaking. "The laws of spirit point to the innate order and intelligence of the universe. They transcend concepts, customs, and beliefs. They form the basis of all human morality. Constant as the movement of the planets, they apply not only to the mechanics of nature, but to every aspect of existence. They can guide you through the shallows and reefs of your life, the way the stars and compass guided ancient mariners on their course. Certain laws," she added, "have special relevance to the practical affairs of human life. The books and teachings of religion touch upon these great truths, simple, powerful principles for finding inner peace in a difficult world. Those who follow the laws prosper and find fulfillment. Those who ignore or resist them meet consequences that instruct them on the journey of awakening, so they can one day find peace in the light of higher understanding." "Where did you learn these laws?" I asked. "They reside inside each of us as a vast storehouse of intuitive wisdom, and they are also revealed everywhere in the natural world." Then, standing swiftly and gracefully, the sage walked to the door and beckoned me to follow. "Come, traveler, let the mountains be your classroom." I resolved to remember whatever laws she might teach me, these treasures she referred to, in order to share them with my children, and perhaps with others who might be interested. But I hadn't begun to realize their full impact, power, and magic. Even so, I knew something unusual was afoot when I stepped through the doorway of the hut and found myself a stone's throw from a large, placid pond I'd never seen before. "We're downwind, so he doesn't yet sense our presence," said the sage softly, directing my gaze to the edge of the pond where a white bird balanced perfectly on one leg. "Can you balance like the egret?" she asked. "What, you mean stand on one leg?" "I mean feel what the egret feels inside. Can you remain as calm in the midst of your everyday life?" "Well, yes, maybe. I don't know. I'm still trying to figure out how we got here." She repeated her question. "You don't often feel such serenity, do you?" "Well, no, I suppose not." "An honest answer and a good starting point," said the sage, as she sat down on the sunny knoll overlooking the pond. "Consider for a moment the importance of balance in the natural order of human life. We are creatures of moderation. We can't swim as well as fish, run as fast as a cheetah, or lift as much as a gorilla. But we have all these abilities in moderation, in balance." The sage pointed again toward the snowy egret, still poised at the water's edge. "Every human body yearns for and thrives in a state of balance, inner peace. Can you feel this inside you now?" The instant she placed her palm on my chest, I felt a profound sense of peace pervade my body and quiet my mind. "You feel it," she whispered. "Yes," I sighed with pleasure. "This feeling of serenity provides a reference point. It will increase your awareness of and decrease your tolerance for the imbalances you normally experience." "In what way?" "Well, you can understand how it does little good to advise tense people to relax if they don't know what relaxed feels like. But once they experience a state of deep relaxation, they have a reference point. They can more easily notice tension as it arises and take steps to release it. And once you know what true balance feels like, you'll begin to notice what's out of balance in any area of your life. This serves as an automatic signal to you to return to that centered place within. You apply the law of balance by noticing your imbalances." "As simple as that." She laughed. Very simple, but not always easy, because whatever physical or emotional state you're accustomed to feeling, even if it's tension or extreme imbalance, will feel normal to you. What many people call neurosis is actually an imbalance or exaggeration of a thought, impulse, or emotion we all feel at times. So shifting to a state of true balance may actually feel odd at first. Then how can I make the shift toward true balance? Just then a fish broke the surface of the pond, sending ripples radiating along its mirrored surface as the sage responded. Go to that quiet place, that still pond inside you. Look, listen. Pay attention to any ripples in your body or your life caused by doing too much or too little in areas of eating, drinking, exercise, work, or communication. As I considered this, another thought arose. With everything going on in the world today, spending all this energy looking inside and finding balance and serenity seems kind of self-centered. Smiling, the sage beckoned me to walk with her around the pond. Many people confuse self-centered with being selfish, she said. But once you find your own balance, your own center, you also find the inner peace and inner power to make a real difference in the world. She bent over then and picked up a thin, straight branch, several feet long, and proceeded to balance it upon one finger. The branch stood perfectly upright at first. Then it began to move slightly to and fro, tilting forward, then backward. Desires and attachments pull you forward, she said. Fear, resistance, and avoidance pull you backward. Extremes of any kind, even taking rigid sides on an issue, can drive you out of that balanced place that values all sides of any issue. Do you understand? I think so, but I'm not sure, I answered. Good. That means you're ready to learn. As we proceeded then along the trail, I noticed that the sage stepped so lightly over fallen branches I could barely hear her footfalls. Her own state of balance was exquisite. Like all the laws I intend to share with you, she continued, the law of balance is not just a philosophy, but a way of life with very practical applications. Seeing my blank look, she picked up a stone, handed it to me, and pointed to a scrub pine about 30 feet away. See that tree trunk over there? Let's see you hit it with the stone. I took a breath, aimed, and threw. I missed by a few feet to the left. She handed me another stone. I threw again and got a little closer, but still to the left of center. She then handed me 4 more stones, looked into my eyes, and spoke slowly. It's important that you hit the tree trunk with one of these stones. I didn't understand why it was so important, but I knew she meant it. I felt my heartbeat quicken. Apply the law of balance, she reminded me. How? I've already told you when you're out of balance, it feels normal to you. Because of this, you keep leaning toward the familiar side. So the fastest way to find center is to overcorrect, to deliberately practice the opposite of what you're used to doing. For example, if you speak too rapidly or too quietly for people to understand you, then you need to deliberately talk in a way that feels too slow or too loud. And since I just threw too far left, I said, I need to aim too far right. Right? Right, she said. The thing is, I only have 4 tries remaining. I don't want to miss that tree to the left or to the right. I want to hit it. I'm sure you do. But once you've worked both sides, it's far easier to find center, whether you're aiming at trees or doing anything else. I understand, I said. Doing is understanding, she replied, pointing to the tree. Doubtful but willing to try, I deliberately aimed to the right. To my surprise, I missed to the left again. You see, said the sage, accustomed to what you usually do, to what feels normal, you undercorrected. That's why changing any habit can feel difficult, and why many people learn slowly. This time, be daring. Make sure the next 2 throws are to the right of the tree. I made very sure. The first stone went a yard to the right, and so did the second. My last try, I said nervously. The law of balance will help you, she said, and so will I. She led me toward the tree until I was only 5 feet away. No one said you had to make life so difficult, she added with a smile. If you notice you're too far away, go too close. Laughing, I hit the tree dead center. As we proceeded along the path around the pond, the sage spoke about another aspect of this law. Balance begins with a breath, she said. Taking in and letting go are the primal rhythms of life. Breathing in, you find inspiration. Breathing out, you find release. Inspiring and expiring, birth and death with every breath. Feel your breath right now, she said. Notice how, when the rhythms of your breathing are out of balance, your emotions are too. So when you feel anger, accept it fully and bring the breath to balance. When you feel sorrow, embrace it tenderly and bring the breath to balance. When you feel fear, honor it and breathe deeply to find your balance. As you exhale, you give. As you inhale, you receive. If you receive more in life than you give, you feel that imbalance is a need to reciprocate and complete the circle of relationship. If you give more than you receive, you can feel depleted and eventually have nothing left to give. Well, wait a minute. I've read about saints who gave much and received very little, I said. So it may appear, but such beings experience abundant joy, love, and gratitude, she responded. The law of balance assures us that those who give freely in the spirit of love and generosity receive in abundance. As we hiked onward up a winding deer trail into the hills, I remembered something she had said when we first met. Earlier you said you needed my assistance, I said, with some kind of mission. This is your preparation, she reminded me. First learn the egret's lesson. Find balance in your life and in all things. Honor this law and follow in the footsteps of the wise. Explore the range of human experience, but since habitual extremes create stress, always return to the golden mean, the middle way. Let your actions and words come forth softly, like the changing seasons. From that inner state of balance, you'll find clarity and peace. As the sage's words faded into silence and we continued up into the hills, I turned for a last glance at the egret, still standing in calm repose at the water's edge. The pond's mirrored surface, shining like polished glass, receded then disappeared as we hiked up over a small rise. Soon after, the trail widened and split into three paths. You lead for a while, said the sage. But I don't know where we're going. She looked up at me and smiled. An interesting belief, traveler, but I think you've always known where you were going, whether or not you were aware of it. So, which path will you choose? Does it make any difference? Ultimately, not at all, she replied. In the end, all paths lead to the same destination. But one of these paths may lead into a green valley, another to a rocky peak, and the third into a dark woods. You can't be sure where each trail leads. Still, you must make a choice. I smiled at her. I get the feeling you're making some kind of a point here. Choose your path, she said. Then we'll talk. Okay, let's go this way, I said, pointing. Well, she said, as if she hadn't heard me. Are you going to choose? I already did. I picked the center path. Again, she spoke, as if deaf to my voice. Our time together is limited, traveler. I suggest you make your choice so we can be on our way. But I... Suddenly, I understood, and I began walking up the center path. Just so. The law of choices tells us that decisions are not made with words, but with actions. Pointing skyward, the sage then asked, Do you see the turkey vulture gliding above us? As I nodded, she knelt down and pointed to a nearby spider in its web. Like the soaring bird and the tiny spider, most of Earth's creatures have a narrow range of choices. They act through instinct and the call of their natures. But you have free will. The power of choice. Your life represents an exercise of this power, and your destiny is determined in large part by the choices you make now. Free will, she continued, means that you can choose to abide by the laws that speak within your deepest intuition, or you can let impulses, fears, and habits run the show. If you sometimes resist or ignore higher wisdom in favor of immediate gratification, the consequences of your choices eventually guide you back toward alignment with the laws of spirit. One choice leads to a sunlit path, and another to hurdles and tests that instruct and strengthen you, so all things serve in their own ways. I don't know, it doesn't always feel as if I've always chosen my directions in life, I said. Sometimes it feels more like fate. Most decisions are directed by subconscious wisdom, she responded. Your inner knower has more information than your conscious mind can access. So there are times when, without knowing why, you attract people or experiences into your life that you don't consciously want, but that do serve your highest good and learning. Well, what about the poor and the abused and the hungry? Are you suggesting they somehow chose to suffer? The sage stopped and gazed into the darkening woods ahead. Pain has many faces. Even the wealthy know suffering. All anyone can do is to make the best possible choices available within a particular set of circumstances. Choices toward life, toward love, toward service, toward connection. But no matter what life dishes out, you get to choose how you will respond internally. You can resist and resent it, bemoaning your fate, or you can face and embrace it, expanding into the moment. Well, what about those who choose discomfort or hardship because they care about someone else? If you willingly choose to set aside your personal desires for the welfare of children, loved ones, or others, that can represent a spiritual act of self-sacrifice. But if you feel like a martyr, it's time to take another look. Assuming too much responsibility for others deprives them of the lessons that arise from the choices they have made. Those in pain need our compassion and support, but if we carry the weight for them, we rob them of their strength and self-respect. I considered her words as we hiked up the path in silence. Then another question struck me. There are times I wonder about the choices I've made, about my relationships, my work. The sage interrupted. When you return home, I suggest you ask your wife for a divorce. What? What are you talking about? Why not get a divorce? You have the power to do so at any time. You just call an attorney. It was my turn to interrupt. I couldn't do that. Why? Because it would cause a lot of pain for my wife, for my children, and for me. The finances would be a mess. And besides, I made a promise when we got married. I made a commitment. And what kind of example would that be to my kids? So you're trapped, she said. No, I'm not trapped. You certainly sound as if you are, she said lightly. You gave a number of reasons, very good ones, I'm sure, why you can't get a divorce. But only when you reclaim the power to end your relationship can you fully commit to it. Only then can you passionately choose to remain married instead of having to, for one reason or another. Do you understand? Yes, I said. I think so. And I'm not just talking about your relationship, she said. This is about your work, your friends, your location, and your life. I don't get that. Well, just as some people, having forgotten the power of choice, feel trapped in a relationship, others feel trapped by their life or by their circumstances, and things have to get very painful before they find the will, the courage, and the self-respect to make new choices. Unless you realize you have the power to say no, she continued, you can never really say yes to your relationships, to your work, to your life, to anything. You don't have to wait to make positive, empowering changes. You don't have to go to school. You don't have to go to work. You don't have to go to war. You don't have to be married or have children or act as other people expect or desire. You don't have to do anything. Just recognize that every action or inaction has consequences, and that your willingness to accept these consequences gives you the power and freedom to choose who you are, where you are, and what you will do. That's when life changes from an obligation to a blessed opportunity. That's when miracles happen. The path I had chosen took us deeper into the woods, beneath a thick canopy of fragrant trees. In that sheltered place, as the wind whispered through the branches overhead, the sage shared her final words on the law of choices. Realizing your power to choose and to change your direction in any moment, without regard to external pressures or ideals, is like rising up toward the surface of the sea after a long submersion. This power may intoxicate you as you see attractive alternatives to your present situation. You may feel tempted to change your relationship, your career, or any area of life that feels difficult or frustrating. Some new choices may be appropriate or even overdue. But the heroic choice often means taking full responsibility for where you are now and participating fully and intentionally with greater presence and passion than ever before. And the more you honor the law of choices, the sage continued, the more you'll live with clear intention, creating your life. And instead of wondering if you are on the right path, with the right person, or doing the right job, you'll live each day by choice and to the fullest. As I considered the choices of my life and how they had brought me here, I thought also of my work and family, reminding me of the home I'd left nearly 8 hours ago. I found myself saying, "I'm very grateful for what you've shown me, but I should return home soon. There are things I have to do around the house." She shrugged. "Choice means giving up something you want for something else you want more. It's your life. Take off whenever you choose." I'd half expected her to try to convince me to stay longer, and her detachment caught me off guard. I had a strange feeling that if I left, there would be no coming back. I guess I can stay a while longer," I replied. "You don't sound very sure." "No, I am, really. I want to stay. I just hadn't expected to be gone this long, and I had some plans." The sage smiled as if she knew me better than I knew myself, which was entirely possible. As the trees opened to an expansive hillside, I was treated to a wide panorama that matched my expanding awareness. It struck me as odd that I saw none of the familiar houses or city beyond, but here with this woman, this being, I felt as if I were in another realm, and for all I knew, the passage of time here was but the blink of an eye in my everyday world. "Let's continue our journey," said the sage, already turning up a steepening path. The trail inclined so sharply that I felt as if we were walking up a steep stairwell straight up the mountain. Although accustomed to hiking, on this grade I felt my heartbeat faster and my breathing deepen. The sage, however, seemed unaffected and spoke without effort. "Have you noticed how this mountain path mirrors the journeys of life, how each day we climb toward our goals?" "I hadn't noticed a path," I replied, panting, as I looked up toward the summit. "But I did notice that the peak doesn't seem to be getting any closer." If one focuses only on the journey's end, completion always appears in the distance. This leads many to abandon their goals when obstacles arise or when the path grows steep. You know that every journey begins with a single step, but you also have to take a second step and a third and as many as necessary to reach your destination. "The law of process," said the sage, "is nature's assurance that we can achieve nearly any goal, no matter how lofty, by breaking it down into small, sure steps." "That seems kind of obvious." "Completely obvious," she agreed. "That's why so many people overlook it." "You said that by taking small steps we can reach nearly any goal?" "Well," she said, smiling, "you can't cross a chasm in 2 leaps. But you can apply a step-by-step process to prepare. And since we don't have any chasms handy..." The sage picked up a stone, handed it to me, and pointed to an oak tree about 20 yards distant. "Do you think you can hit that trunk?" "What, from 60 feet away? I sincerely doubt it. Even if I aim to the left, then to the right, it's just too far." "Okay, then," she replied, leading me directly to the tree until it loomed in front of us. "How about now?" "Of course I can hit it now." "Then do it." So I did. Whereupon she took me 1 foot farther away, handed me another rock, and said, "Again." In this manner, by stepping 1 foot back each time, I succeeded with every throw until we were about 12 yards away, when I missed. Step 1 foot forward, and throw again, she said. My stone again hit dead center. We continued backward until I missed twice at 16 yards, stepped forward 1 foot, then hit it again. Finally, after a few misses, I actually hit the tree from 20 yards. As we forged once again up the steep trail, she continued her instruction. You see how this law works in any area of life? By breaking any task into manageable steps, you don't have to wait for success at journey's end. You create a series of many small successes along the way. We came to a wide stream then, swelled by the spring rains. The sage crossed first, walking lightly across a zigzag path of stepping stones. I followed, hopping from one stone to the next. Seeing two stones close together, I made a quick decision and leaped for the farther one, landed a little short, slipped on some moss, and ended up in the stream. Making no effort to suppress a smile, the sage reached out with a hand. So you see, in any process, traveler, even crossing a stream, if you skip steps, sooner or later, you're going to get wet. After that, the path began to widen, so we could walk side by side. And before long, just as my clothes were about dry, we came to a muddy bog. I looked right and left for a way around, but the sides of the little canyon were steep on either side. The sage threw back her head and laughed. Nature is such a wondrous classroom. Her lessons appear at just the right time. Meaning? Open your eyes, she said. How does this muddy trail reflect your life? Right now, I haven't a clue. Let me spell it out, then. On the path stretching between you and your goals, do you usually find a red carpet? No. More often, I find a swamp. Oh, I get it. Yes, she said. Worthwhile goals demand effort, risk, and sacrifice. You have to persist through fear and doubt. You have to draw on inner resources and become more than you were before. Every new challenge serves as an initiation. You meet discouragement. You overcome discomfort, boredom, and frustration, and you find out what you're made of. As we sloshed ankle-deep through the mud, she added, What pulls you through the muddy paths of life is the vision that inspired you to begin the quest, the goal on the other side. It can draw you like a magnet through the muck and mire. So the first step in any process is creating a direction, choosing a goal that shines for you. That's sometimes a tough question for me, deciding what goal to pursue. Well, you won't discover it by waiting for divine revelation, absolute certainty, mystical vision, or the voice of God. So don't weigh ideas or wonder. Don't doubt your direction or depend on others to tell you what you should or shouldn't do. Go toward what attracts or excites or inspires you, toward what touches your heart. Ask yourself what's worth the effort and the sacrifices that come with commitment to any goal. As we washed off our muddy feet and shoes in a stream, the sage offered some additional advice. Remember, traveler, that lofty dreams in the distant future are a difficult burden to carry. The best goals may be those you can handle in the next week, the next day, the next hour, or the next step. Create a process that yields many small successes. Many small successes, I repeated to myself as we continued up a ravine. But what about people who seem to achieve fame overnight? Where was their process? I asked the sage. Any truly successful venture, she responded, is like building a house. It begins with a strong foundation and proceeds patiently toward completion. Some houses, or careers, are built quickly but without a stable foundation. They look beautiful, but they don't stand up for long. If you look closely at overnight successes, you'll find that they usually took about 10 years of preparation. 10 years, I said mostly to myself. Think of it, she said. In 10 years, you can accomplish nearly anything. You can become a physician or a scientist. You can develop high-level skills in a sport, game, or martial art. You can become an expert on any subject. You can create wealth or transform your body. 10 years still seems like a long time. Looking forward, yes. But looking backward, centuries pass in the snap of a finger, in the blink of an eye. Abruptly, she pointed skyward. Look, up there, at the summit. I looked. It still seemed far away. Now look back, she said. so I turned to view the hills below. We've come a long way, step by step. We've been walking and talking for hours. That might have sounded like a long time if I had told you when we began, but looking back... I finished your sentence. It doesn't seem long at all. We then headed up through the clump of trees into a darkly shaded area, losing sight of the sky. The sage knelt down and picked up an acorn and explained. The same way this tiny acorn grows into a towering oak, the same way a river patiently carves a canyon from stone, the same way you've grown from a helpless infant into a mature man, you can and will accomplish all that you desire, one step at a time. Well, you make it sound so certain. How can you be sure? After all, even going step by step, one can still fail. Few things are certain in this world, she said, but people rarely ever fail. They only stop trying. As we stepped out from the cover of trees into a larger canopy of sky, we turned and looked at the hills below as the sage offered some final words on the law of process. Lasting progress doesn't happen in a few dramatic moments, but hour by hour, day by day. And as time passes, every process includes repairs. The road to happiness is always under construction. Focus on taking life one step at a time until you get it right. Set aside what you can do later. When discipline and patience join forces, they become a persistence that endures past the peaks and valleys to carry intentions to completion. Enthusiasm sets the pace, but persistence reaches the goal. Process, patience, and persistence are keys that unlock the doorway to any destination. The treasure isn't only a journey's end, you see. The process itself is its own reward. We found ourselves standing on the summit. Wiping my brow, I surveyed the magnificent view below, all the sweeter for having been earned. I looked toward the sage as she pointed toward yet another higher peak in the distance and another beyond that. You will find that as we reach one goal, we create another, for the journey continues ever onward, she said, as we turned back down the mountain. Our hike went down more quickly than the climb up. But I was so lost in thought that I hardly noticed. Where are we going? What will we be doing next? Will I be able to remember what she is telling me? When will I get home? Will I see her tomorrow? As if in response to my inner pondering, she said, "You seem preoccupied, so perhaps now is a good time to describe the law of presence." Yes, she reflected, now is always a good time. The sage pointed out over the hills below and asked, "Do you see how the sun illuminates that field of daffodils over there against the emerald grasses? To me, they're as beautiful as any work of art in any museum of the world." Then she turned and we walked in silence as the colors slipped from the twilight sky. A few minutes later, as we rounded a wall of familiar boulders, her hut came into view. The sage opened her thatch door and once again invited me inside. She quickly set the fire to crackling. Then she stood and excused herself to go outside, I assumed to take care of her physical needs, as I had done earlier. As the minutes passed and she didn't reappear, I began to fidget, wondering when she would be back and how I'd find my way home in the dark, if indeed I returned home at all tonight. I supposed I could always sleep in the hills, and the temperature was cool but not cold, and my family wouldn't return until Monday afternoon, 2 days hence. What happened next was so bizarre that I began to doubt my senses. Instead of the sage, a large cat entered the hut. She walked in deliberately as if she knew exactly where she was going. She had a dark, shiny coat, part Siamese maybe, and part, well, part sage. I say this because the next thing I knew, she spoke to me, not with her mouth, but with her mind. Her voice was like that of the sage, only quieter. She sat tall as cats do, looked right at me, and got to the point. "Have you ever considered how time is a paradox?" she asked, before daintily licking the fur on her shoulder. Feeling very strange, I answered aloud, "I can't say that I have. Not since reading my last time travel novel, anyway." Her voice again resonated in my ears or my mind. "Time stretches between the past and future that have no reality. Time is a convention of thought and language, a social agreement. In other words, time exists because we say it does? Exactly so, she whispered. Time is like a film of your life that consists of separate frames passing in front of a lens. Each frame is where you exist, in a present moment. But the frames appear to move. You can project your mind into what you call the past or the future. But you cannot live in any moment other than the present. I and my kind are masters of the present moment. Having said this, she stretched, lay down gracefully, and attended once again to her fur. I considered what she'd said. I'd always liked cats, despite their air of aloof superiority. And as crazy as it seemed to learn the law of presence from a cat, it also felt completely appropriate. No cat I've ever known gave much due to past or future. Like the wisest of sages, cats live each moment afresh. The cat looked up at me with complete attention. I and my kind have presence because I am totally present, here and now. Can you say the same? Me? Well, yes. I sometimes feel like I'm right here. That is... By the time I had stammered this far, she had turned to more important things like watching a moth in the light of the fire. As if I hadn't said anything worth a comment, she continued, "What you did this morning or yesterday or last year has now vanished except in your mind. What is to come is only a dream. We have only this moment, you see." "I see," I said, not at all sure of exactly what I saw. "I'm not done," she continued. "Are you aware that your sense of time passing is only an array of impressions and memories happening in the present moment? Regrets of the past are present impressions happening now. Future anxieties have no reality except in your mind, in this moment, as images, sounds, and feelings. In other words, past and future are happening now as you create them." In a vague attempt to get some high ground, I said, "If this is the law of presence, it seems rather abstract to me." "Time is the abstraction," she replied. "However, you can apply the law of presence in very practical ways to banish regrets, concerns, or confusion. Your ability to refocus attention back to the present moment grows with practice. Someday you may be able to do this as I do, quite naturally." So much for the high ground, I thought. This cat had a point, and she clearly practiced what she preached. Then my mind drifted for a moment, and I looked toward the door. Where was the sage? She should have been back long ago. "Hello?" "Oh," I heard the cat say, snapping me back to the present. "Do you understand how the law of presence can change your life forever?" Forever, of course, being right now. "I already know the value of living in the present," I retorted, trying to salvage a little self-respect. "Knowing and doing aren't necessarily the same thing, especially in your case," she purred, looking extremely pleased with herself. "Whenever you have a problem, it involves something past or future. You keep problems alive in your present mind by giving them your attention and energy, letting them live rent-free in your head. I, in contrast, don't give them the time of day. Life's too short," she said with finality. "Well, thank you, Your Highness," I said. "Are you finished?" "Not by a long shot. Not until you truly understand that past and future are nothing more than a bad habit of the mind, of your mind. Concerns about past or future are like the delusions of a crazy man who hears voices or sees creatures that exist only in his imagination, present company excluded, of course." The irony of hearing this from a talking cat did not escape me. "But," she continued, "as you notice what you're doing more and more, you can overcome this habit as you might any other, by remembering and applying the law of presence." She stopped licking her fur and gave me her undivided attention. "I sincerely hope you appreciate the law of presence and the time I've taken to explain it to you." Without waiting for my response, she continued, "Presence is like a time machine that lightens the mind, liberates you from anxiety, and gives birth to a new way of living. In other words, you become more like me." "I can hardly wait," I said, then laughed. "As I've said, in order to have presence, you have to be present and remember where you are and when you are. Then you will know who you are. presence teaches that what you do today is important because you are trading a day of your life for it. So let this law sweep your mind clear of unnecessary debris and return you to a state of clarity, simplicity, and inner peace. Just like you, I said. I'm so glad you noticed, she purred. And remember that no matter how real or compelling your thoughts may be, you can always call upon the law of presence, reminding yourself that only now exists, that only now is real. If you do so as an act of reverence, making this moment sacred, you bow to that quiet, cat-like self inside that knows, and all is well. So it's that easy to become cat-like? It may be a considerable stretch in your case, she said, arching her back, yawning and walking around the fire towards the door. Embrace this moment. Put one foot in front of the other and handle what's in front of you. Because no matter where your mind may roam, your body always remains here and now. When in haste, rest in the present. Take a deep breath and come back to here and now. The cat once again stretched luxuriously, and without another word, walked out the door. Almost as soon as the cat left, the sage reappeared and sat down, without explanation. Now, where was I, she said. Ah, yes, we were discussing the law of presence. I think that was already covered pretty well, I said. Did I detect something like amusement in her eyes? And where have you been, I asked. Oh, outside, enjoying the night air, leaning against the back of the hut. There, behind you. But wait a minute, were you... I didn't even bother to finish. I just watched as the sage, with great presence, put a small kettle suspended on a green stick over the fire and dropped in some tea leaves. I wondered whether we would be talking into the night, but then I let it go and enjoyed the moment, and the tea, which, as it turned out, was superb. Gazing over the small fire, I could see the flames reflected in the sage's eyes. Her face, now illuminated by the firelight, appeared ageless, except for a few lines around the eyes. From smiling, I supposed. She smiled often, so that even when she seemed deeply serious, I could detect an underlying sense of humor and perspective. After we spent some time in silence, gazing into the burning embers, she invited me outside to learn the law of compassion. We rose together and stepped through the doorway. I looked around in wonder. Had the terrain changed again, or was it a trick of the moonlight? Before us lay a level area with enough trees to offer shelter from a misting rain that settled the day's dust and carried a pleasant, earthy odor of bark and leaves mixed with soil and grasses. Everything feels so alive, I remarked. And so it is, she responded as she caressed the rough bark of a nearby tree. In the light of a waxing moon, the rolling hills became curves on the earth's body. Extend your mind far beyond these hills, she continued. Reach across the oceans, the fjords, the volcanoes, the reefs, the towering mountains above and beneath the sea, all teeming with life, all of it, the flesh and bones, the blood and spirit of the earth, our mother. She held up her finger to show me a tiny flea, which leaped up and disappeared. If you were a flea, she said, standing on the back of an elephant, you would see only a forest of great hairs growing up around you, with no idea what you actually stood upon. But if you leaped high into the air and looked back, you'd see that you actually lived on the skin of a living creature. This is what happened to the astronauts who first soared into space. They left Earth as scientists and pilots and came back as mystics, because they saw the vision of a single, glorious, sacred, blue-green, living, breathing planet. This vision brings humility, and with it a sense of awe and compassion that carries into the affairs of ordinary life. Just as you can learn balance from an egret and presence from a cat, you can learn the law of compassion from the earth on whose skin we tread, whose trees we cut and burn, whose living wealth we exploit, going about our business without ever thinking of asking permission or giving thanks. The sage looked up into the night sky. For many centuries, I've spoken with the earth. I know her heart, and I say to you that she understands in a way so deep and profound that tears would come to your eyes if you could but touch the edges of her compassion. The earth forgives us because she knows that we are flesh of her flesh. We are a part of her that is still learning and growing. And so I ask you this, the sage continued, squatting down, taking some rich soil in her hands and letting it run through her fingers. If the earth can forgive you for your mistakes, can you not forgive yourself and offer others the same compassion? I lay back and looked up at the starry sky. I don't think I'm all that good at compassion, I said. You don't give much of it to yourself, do you? She asked gently. No, I don't suppose I do. Then that's where to begin. The more loving kindness you give yourself, the more you can give to others. She rose and walked back inside the hut. I followed. Gazing at me over the crackling fire with a light in her eyes, the sage revealed the heart of this law. The time has come, traveler, for you to see yourself and others in a new way, free of the judgments and expectations that come between you and the world. The time has come to understand that all of us, friends and adversaries alike, are doing the best we know how within the limits of our beliefs and capacities. The poet Rumi once wrote, "Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there." When the soul lies down in that grass, the world is too full to talk about. Rumi could write these words because he understood that judgments are a human invention, she said. That God is not here to judge us, but to provide us the means to learn from our errors so that we can grow and evolve. The sage turned to me and asked, "If you can accept that God doesn't judge you, why should you judge others?" "I try not to judge others," I said, "but what about violent or cruel people?" "The law of compassion is not arbitrary or conditional," she said. "We know that deeply troubled and destructive people do exist in this world, and that disturbed people tend to disturb others. Compassion doesn't mean letting such people walk over you to continue their destructive behaviors. Some individuals need to be separated from society. But one can have compassion for evil without succumbing to it. In battle, you can feel compassionate toward your adversaries even when fighting to the death." "But why feel compassion for cruel or despicable people? Why not just hate what is hateful?" "That is an important question and deserves a clear answer, an answer you must find for yourself. But consider this, hate and compassion are different kinds of energy. Which do you want to fill your world?" "I can't argue with your goodwill," I responded, "but I still find it very difficult to feel kindly towards bigots or those who prey on children." "I never said that compassion was easy," the sage replied. "But easy or not, the law directs you to act out of love and understanding, rather than out of hatred or ignorance. To do so requires a leap to a larger perspective, to the realization that you live in a universe as just as it is mysterious. This depth of understanding flows from intuitive insight into the inherent intelligence of the universe. Whether you find such understanding through observation, through reason, or through religious faith, it reveals finally that in the natural world, you have no friends, you have no enemies, you only have teachers." "Well, it seems to me one has to be a saint to practice this law." Smiling, she answered, "The law of compassion presents a loving demand to transcend our limited perspectives. This can feel overwhelming at times. So remember that compassion starts with yourself. Be gentle and patient. We each have many thoughts and feelings, both positive and negative, that arise in the mind and heart. You don't have to be a saint. But instead of believing or resisting the negative thoughts, let compassion wash them away in a wave of love and understanding." "It still sounds pretty saintly." The sage stood and paced for a few moments before turning to face me. "Can you remember a time in your life when you were in the midst of a heated argument, when you felt resentful, envious, or betrayed?" "Yes," I said. "Go back to one of those times," she said, "and feel the pain and anger." "Okay, I feel it." "Now imagine in the midst of this heated argument, that the person you're arguing with suddenly clutches his or her heart, utters a cry, and falls dead at your feet. My God, I said, picturing what she'd asked. Where is your anger now? Where is your envy and jealousy, your resentment and pain? Well, those feelings are gone, I answered. But what if I were glad they were dead? What if I couldn't forgive them? Then you can forgive yourself for not forgiving them. And in that forgiveness, you'll find the compassion that heals the pain of being a human in this world. To call forth such forgiveness whenever you need it, she added, remember to imagine your friend, lover, or adversary lying dead at your feet, as you will one day lie at the feet of spirit. Then you will see through different eyes, because death is the great equalizer. We are all going to depart this world and leave those we love. We all feel hope and despair. We all share dreams and loss. We are all joined, without knowing why, in the mystery of life, doing the best we can. Maybe that's what Plato was saying when he wrote, "Be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a hard battle." Yes, said the sage, now you understand. With that, she walked over to a bed of leaves and lay down. I watched her for a few moments in the fading glow of the fire as the last embers flickered and died. When I awoke, she was gone, and I had no idea whether she would return. I rose quickly, stepped outside, and looked for her, but I could find no sign, not even a footprint. As the minutes passed, doubts drifted like dark clouds across my mind. Did she really exist? Or was it all some kind of wondrous dream? No, of course it had been real, and good, and true. Then, as I scanned the woods, I caught sight of her, standing in the quiet morning shadows next to three deer, a doe, and two fawns. In that moment, she seemed one of them, a deer in human form, and I felt like an outsider. They turned at the same time and saw me. The deer stepped into the deeper cover of the trees and disappeared as the sage approached me. There's something I'd like to show you, she said, giving me a handful of the season's early blackberries. The deer like them, but you may find them bitter. She was right. Still, they satisfied my hunger and filled me with a sense of lightness and vitality. Then we were off on a morning hike. Stopping only to drink with cupped hands from a small waterfall, I followed her, stride for stride, onto a small grassy knoll where there grew a colorful field of flowers, reds, yellows, and dazzling blues. Watching blossoms open to the morning light reminds me of the law of faith, said the sage. Is this law about religion? I asked. Faith doesn't require a belief in an external God, only a belief in flowers, she said, smiling. But if one appreciates flowers, one must certainly appreciate God. Not as a belief, but as a feeling of wonder and mystery. The law of faith is about trusting the inherent love and intelligence working through you and all of creation. Well, I can't honestly say I trust everyone. The sage laughed. Faith is not blind. We all know of people who are dishonest or dangerous, and so we need to be strong and vigilant in this world. That's why an Arab sage once offered the reminder, "Trust in Allah, but tie your camel." Practicing the law of faith doesn't mean trusting every person to do the right thing. It has a higher, more transcendent meaning. Faith is the recognition that spirit works in, as, and through each and all of us, through every person in every circumstance. Faith is also an attitude that whatever happens serves a higher good, despite appearances to the contrary. That's kind of a stretch, isn't it? Especially if one experiences a tragedy. Faith is one of the greatest stretches, one of the greatest leaps a human being can take, because all you have to go on is, well, faith. So how can I make that leap? The sage sat down, settling like a leaf on the grassy slope, and asked me, what if you suddenly knew with certainty that a higher intelligence was working through you and everyone else for the highest good of humanity, that there is indeed a purpose for every pleasure and hardship? Well, if I knew that, it would make a difference. The law of faith doesn't require you to believe this, traveler, but it guides you to live your life as if this were true, in other words, on faith. And as you live in the light of this law, it will transform your perception and experience of the world. You'll begin to see every difficulty as a test in order to instruct you. You'll find lessons and opportunities in every challenge. Are you suggesting that I value faith over reason? She laughed, apparently finding my comment amusing. Faith is not the opposite of reason. Applying the law of faith is one of the most practical, reasonable, constructive things you can do to live an inspired life. Reaching out to touch one of the flower petals, she added, "As one of nature's most delicate and vulnerable life forms, a flower's life is short and tenuous. A careless footfall, a dry winter, or pounding rain can make a life and death difference to a delicate blossom. And yet, each morning it opens wide. Flowers have much to teach us about faith. When you cultivate the garden of faith in your own life, you will, like this flower, come alive in a new way." I looked down and touched the delicate blossom, so soft and so vulnerable. For the first time, I realized that I didn't even have the faith of a flower. The sage's next words responded precisely to my innermost feelings. "Faith is not a commodity that you own or possess," she said. "It's the divine order that pervades all things, the light behind your eyes, the loving and mysterious intelligence that emanates from the center of creation." "How can I experience that kind of faith in my everyday life?" I asked. "To begin, listen to the intuitive wisdom of your heart, where spirit speaks. So many people rely on books, teachers, scientists, psychics, oracles, or others to advise or direct them or to validate their views. But aren't I relying on your advice and direction?" A light drizzle began to fall, turning to a downpour. The sage led me under the cover of overhanging branches as she responded. "Teachers and books have their value, and sources of guidance and inspiration may enter your life in different forms. But never forget that the treasure is already inside you. Others cannot give you anything you don't already have. They can only provide keys to your own inner wealth. So listen well to those who speak from experience and embrace wisdom where you find it. But always weigh external guidance against the wisdom of your own heart." There are times I've trusted myself, made a decision, and been wrong. "You may choose one path over another, then meet with great hardship and difficulty as a result of that decision. But does that necessarily mean it was the wrong choice in terms of your highest good and learning?" "Well, no, I guess not." "Faith is assuming that you always make the right choice." "I'd love to have that much faith in myself." "Self-trust," she offered, "develops naturally from your own direct experience. You learn to trust your body's instincts, your heart's intuition, and your mind's ability to access universal intelligence." As a light sprinkle of rain cooled my forehead, the sage pointed to water pouring out of a crack in a nearby rock, forming a waterfall that splashed onto the boulders below. "Do you see how the water appears to pour out of the rocks?" she asked. "Yet you know that the water comes not from the rocks, but through them, that the water source is above. Like water, higher wisdom doesn't come as much from your brain as through it. You aren't a vessel to be filled with facts. You are more like a radio receiver, attuned to the universal intelligence operating throughout creation. All you have to do is listen and trust." "I wish I were as certain of that as you," I said. The sage smiled again. "Faith means living with uncertainty, traveler, feeling your way through life, letting your heart guide you like a lantern in the dark. There is no absolute security except in absolute faith. This doesn't mean that all circumstances will go your way or that divine justice is operating every time you injure or heal yourself. All sorts of things, both beautiful and terrible, can happen in this world. Our small mind cannot always see the bigger picture or know what is for our highest good. So despite the confusion and uncertainty of life, when you can learn to live on faith, like the flower, trusting spirit working according to a higher will beyond the reach of your mind, you'll see spirit operating everywhere in everyone and everything." For several minutes, as we hiked over a rise and down a curving trail, my mind rested in silence, until, finally, another question arose. When I'm able to access such inner wisdom, will I be guided like you and avoid making so many mistakes? She laughed. A few weeks ago, I tripped and fell halfway down the hill. Really? Really. But while I was lying there, I found a beautiful stone I would have missed had I not fallen. So you see, faith is not about being infallible and always having everything go your way. Faith involves a willingness to stretch yourself, make mistakes, and learn from them. In other words, to trust the process of your life. The more you trust spirit in this way, the more you will work with it directly as a living force. As the sage finished speaking, the rain stopped. Stepping out from under some trees into the warm sunlight, I felt an extraordinary sense of calm and well-being. In that moment, I knew that despite the challenges and tests confronting humanity, our world was in the hands of spirit, unfolding like a flower toward the light.